Good morning and welcome to the Health Matters Radio Show with me, Neil De Silva. I hope you're all keeping well and you had a great weekend. It's Monday, it's the 29th of October, and we have a great show ahead of you this morning. We have music from Queen, from Rod Stewart, and also from Kate Bush. I have a special guest on with me this morning, Carol Macy. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
And how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you.
Fantastic. And we're going to find out more about what Carol does in about 20 minutes or so. So we're also going to be talking about type 2 diabetes, and type 2 diabetes, as many of you know, is a specialism of mine. I'm going to talk about the undiagnosed symptoms of type 2 diabetes, and we're also going to have a chat about employee well-being and health in the workplace towards the end of the show. So before we start, a quick disclaimer. The purpose of the Health Matters radio show is to provide you with competent information on the subject matters covered and to help educate and inform you in ways that you can improve your own health. However, this is on the understanding that I am not engaged in providing medical advice, and the content in the show should not be treated as a substitute for such. If you have any concerns about your general health or you require medical or other expert assistance, please speak to a suitably qualified healthcare professional, which in many cases can be obtained by dialing 111 first or speaking with your local pharmacist. All content is provided for general information only, and I encourage you to do your own research. And the Health Matters radio show is based on my knowledge, my research, my experience, and often my opinion, and I disclaim any liability that is incurred from the use of or application of the show. Okay, so on to diabetes, type 1, type 2. And I've covered the differences between type 1 and type 2 in the past. And as many of you know, type 1 is an autoimmune condition, which for the vast majority of people is pretty much outside their control. Often comes on quite young, and it often comes on quite quickly as well. Type 2 diabetes, however, is a condition that for the most part can be influenced by an individual's lifestyle, their diet, sometimes the medication that they take. Some medications actually raise blood sugars and cause diabetic symptoms later on in life. It causes things like insulin resistance. It can cause weight gain. It can have a massive effect on your eyes and your kidneys and your nervous system. And there are links between type 2 diabetes and dementia, which are being researched at the moment. So type 1 is kind of outside someone's control, and type 2 is within our control for the most part. So type 2 is a preventable condition. And type 2 diabetes, or the management of type 2, is one of the things I specialise in. So as we go through this piece, if you can identify with any of the things that I'm talking about and you want to have a chat with me, you can contact me via my website, which is www.i-nutrition.co.uk. So in 1996, there were 1.4 million type 2 diabetics in the UK. And over the course of 20 years, 1.4 million became 3.5 million in 2016. And that number is expected to grow to over 5 million over the next 5 years. So despite all the efforts made to halt the obesity epidemic and the type 2 diabetes epidemic, the experts suggest that these numbers are going to increase to over 5 million by 2025. And I think at the moment there's about 60 or 70 million type 2 diabetics in America. And there's, I think at the last count, there's nearly 200 million in China. So it is a real global epidemic. And in the UK, around 700 people a day are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. But the really scary thing is that there are around, or it's estimated, anything up to 750,000 people that have type 2 diabetes, and they don't actually know that they have type 2 diabetes at the moment. And as I mentioned at the start, it's one of those conditions that often takes a long time before the symptoms become manifest. And up to the point that it's actually diagnosed as a condition, the body has amazing mechanisms in place to try to combat the onset of type 2 diabetes. In terms of things like how it manages blood sugar, it has tremendously complex mechanisms to try to keep your blood sugar within a certain window, so not too high and not too low. But it's when the body can't cope anymore that often these physical symptoms actually become manifest. And we're going to go through some of these physical symptoms in a moment. And it's really important that you understand these. Now, it doesn't mean that if you can identify with one or two of these that you are automatically a type 2 diabetic and that you should get worried. However, if you can identify with a few of them and you haven't had your blood glucose levels checked for a while or you haven't spoken to your GP, it may be worth having a conversation. Because if you can nip type 2 diabetes in the blood, in the bud, then you can often mitigate the risk of it developing into full-blown type 2 diabetes and with all the complications that go with it. So here are some of the symptoms that you may be able to identify with. And I do stress it doesn't mean you're a type 2 diabetic, but if you can identify with a few of these, then it might be worth having a chat with your GP. So the first of these is increased thirst. Because of the mechanism of dealing with high levels of blood sugar, and we'll come on to going to the toilet in a moment, you suffer with dehydration, and it is linked to going to the toilet, because actually if you're suffering really high blood sugars, one of the mechanisms that your body has to get rid of the excess glucose is to expel it through your urine. So if you're going to the toilet a lot, and if your pee is dark and you're dehydrated, that can be a symptom, particularly if you're going to the toilet a lot at night. But when you combine going to the toilet a lot with dehydration, obviously you're going to be more thirsty. So if you have a constant need to drink, and that thirst is never quenched, then that could be a symptom of undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. Increased hunger. Now, because of the mechanism of insulin and the increase in blood glucose and the fact that this extra energy, all this energy in the glucose, has trouble getting into the cells, whilst there is all this glucose in the blood, the cells actually can starve because they can't take the glucose out of the blood. And as a result of that, you can feel hungry all the time, even though you're eating a lot. So increased hunger can be a symptom of undiagnosed type 2. If you have a dry mouth, again, dry mouth linked to thirst, dehydration. If you have a dry mouth a lot and you are drinking a lot and that's not going away, then again, perhaps chat to your GP. Itching down below. Now, when you start urinating glucose, the bacteria, particularly for ladies, the bacteria that live down there can actually feed on this increased level of glucose that's being expelled through the urine. Now, when the bacteria feed on this glucose, then obviously they can multiply and they can get out of control. And this provides the perfect breeding ground to yeast infections. Now, it doesn't mean that if you have a yeast infection, it means you're undiagnosed type 2 diabetic. But if you get them on a regular basis, then it might be worth having a conversation. If you're fatigued, if you have constant headaches, these can be symptoms of undiagnosed type 2. And blurred vision. Now, blurred vision is an interesting one because the increase in glucose in the blood has an impact on the small arteries within the and the capillaries within the eye. So if you're struggling to see clearly, if you have intermittent blurred vision, if you have the floaters, you see the floaters in your eye if you close your eyes sometimes. If you have more than, everyone gets them, but if you get them on a regular basis, it could be linked to undiagnosed type 2 because this increase in blood sugar does cause disruption to the eye's lens, and it can also make the eye lens, the eye itself become dry or swollen. So if you have any issues with your vision, then again, that might be worth a conversation. And this is one of the reasons, if you have your eyes checked on a regular basis, and I think it's recommended you do it every 2 years, even if your vision is okay, that when you have your eyes checked, they actually do look at the back of the eye and they do check for type 2 diabetes at the same time. If you have slow healing of cuts and grazes and bruises, then again, the way high blood glucose acts on the body, it can actually impair the immune system. So if cuts and grazes are taking longer to heal, then that can be a symptom. And nausea and vomiting. If you notice an increase in unexplained nausea and sickness, it could be a sign of diabetes because these blood sugar fluctuations can disrupt the metabolism, and it can also cause dizziness, which can make people feel sick. So things to consider if you're overweight, obviously that is a is a prerequisite of type 2 diabetes. It's not always a hard and fast rule, but if you're carrying too much weight and if your waistline is more than half of your height, so if you're 6 foot, i.e. 72 inches, and your waistline is more than half of that, which is 36 inches, then that can be an indicator of the possibility of type 2 diabetes. If you've got a bad diet, if you drink too many sugary drinks, if you've got family history of diabetes, that increases your risk. And if you're very sedentary, that can increase your risk of type 2 as well. So the key takeaway here is actually type 2 diabetes generally doesn't come on quick. It can take up to a decade to develop to a point where these symptoms become physical. And by the time they've become physical, it's already been going for quite a long time already. So if you can spot some of the signs beforehand and you can deal with them, you can sometimes avoid the onset of type 2 becoming full-blown type 2. And as I mentioned, if you want to talk to me, you can contact me via my website. We'll have a chat about it and I'll see if I can help you. And my website is www.i-nutrition.co.uk. So before we go into our guest interview, we have a quick song to take us there. It's quite apt at the moment. There is a new film out and I'm looking forward to seeing it in the next week or two. But to take us into our guest interview, we have a great classic by Queen and it's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Real life, is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter.
Will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo, Figaro,
Magnifico.
Oh, I'm just a poor boy and nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy
easy go? Will you let me go?
Bismillah.
No, we will not let you go.
Let him go.
Bismillah.
We will not let you go.
Let him go.
Bismillah.
We will not let you go.
Let me go.
We will not let you go.
Let me go.
We will not let you go.
Let me go. Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia.
Mamma mia, let me go.
Beelzebub has a devil put aside.
What a fabulous song. And I thought I would play that out right to the last second because it's such a good song. You're listening to the Health Matters Radio Show with me, Neil De Silva. I hope you're all keeping well out there. And we're going to go on now to our guest interview with Carol Macy. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on the show this morning.
It's good to be here.
And we're going to find out more about Carol's background, how she got into doing what she does now, and also the ways that she may be able to help you or maybe someone that you know. So, Carol, that's the start at the beginning. What's your background and how did you get into doing what you currently do?
Okay, well, I have a background in mental health nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I became interested in that was because when I had my son, I suffered with quite bad postnatal depression.
Okay.
And it got me really interested in mental health. So I did a degree in psychology. And then at the end of it, I didn't really know where I was going to go. So I decided to look into mental health nursing. And felt that that was the right route for me to help other people that have got mental health issues. Because I do truly believe that looking at your mental health, looking after your mental health, is just as important as your physical health.
Absolutely.
And certainly one impacts on the other. So that's one of the reasons why I did that. I suppose about 7 or 8 years ago, I came across an article in the Nursing Times about life coaching.
Mm.
And it sounded really interesting. And so I thought I'm going to look into that. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to qualify as a life coach, because I thought I could help people manage their mental health and overcome any obstacles that might be, you know, stopping them from moving on, stopping them from moving forward.
Yeah.
Which is why I decided to specialise in helping people overcome a mental, you know, mental health issues or emotional issues,
mm-hmm.
In order for them to achieve the goals in their life.
So, what sort of issues do you come up against people with? Things like eating disorders, I guess. And
yes, I have had people with eating disorders. Anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Is quite a big one. Depression, people, you know, they're depressed because things are not going well in their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, to offer hope, really, so that they can overcome these things.
I did a show a month or two ago, which was purely about mental health. And it covered the things like the use of our language and how we can be very empathetic to people who do suffer with depression.
Yes.
By not just saying, oh, I'm feeling a little bit depressed today. Because actually, and you've got first-hand experience of it, depression isn't feeling just a little bit down, is it? Depression is far more serious than just feeling just a little bit low today.
Yes, it can be quite debilitating.
Yeah.
I don't think people realise how prevalent it is. I mean, statistics say 1 in 4 of the population.
25%, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But
yeah.
I suspect it's probably more than that.
Mm.
It's probably just scratching the surface. If you think about the mental health continuum, so you can be one end or the other, so you can be perfectly mentally well or very, very mentally unwell.
Mm-hmm.
We're all on that continuum. And depending on what's happening in our lives, it can fluctuate.
Yeah, absolutely. And this link between mental health and physical health, I think it's becoming more mainstream now. I think mental health issues were often kind of not brushed to the side, but they certainly weren't taken as seriously as physical health, were they? And now, obviously, mental health has come to the fore and people are talking. And there is still a bit of a stigma around mental health, I think, and quite wrongly, but I think more people are now open to discussion about mental health issues.
I think so. And, I think with the young royal princes getting involved as well, and you know, like Prince Harry has spoken about his own mental health issues after the death of Princess Diana, is making it more acceptable for people to talk about how they feel emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than it used to be. And, you know, there's Mental Health Awareness Days now.
Yes, we had one a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? World Mental Health Awareness Day. Was it World or was it UK?
I think it was World Mental
Health Day. I think you're right. So your goal when it comes to mental health is to try to help raise awareness of it and to try to contribute towards breaking this stigma that we still have in our society today.
Yeah, that's partly my role, but also helping people that you know, where their mental health is being affected by lifestyle, mm-hmm. by events, some things that they need to overcome. It's very easy to stay stuck when you've got mental health issues and feel you can't move forward. But that's not true. I mean, lots of people with mental health issues manage their lives really, really well. Sometimes you need support with that.
And do you find that lots of people do, certainly before they come and talk to you, that they've suffered in silence for a long time?
Often, yes.
Mm. Yeah, because we can't see it, we think it's not there.
Yes. And you know, it's other people around them don't understand why they're the way they are.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, as I said, I think the whole awareness of it is starting to improve. I think we have a long, long way to go.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah,
Before it's sorted.
That's why I want to keep, you know, plugging away and, you know, and looking at confidence and self-esteem issues.
Yeah.
A lot of my clients come to me with low confidence, low self-esteem. For various reasons. So I do a lot of work around building confidence, building self-esteem.
Okay.
Helping people feel good about themselves so they're in a better place to make positive changes.
Excellent. So what other ways do you help people? Obviously, we've spoken about the emotional issues, but how do you use your life coaching techniques to help people to move forwards?
I do a lot of goal setting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great believer in SMART goal setting, which means you set small, specific goals. And when people actually manage to reach those goals, it's amazing how much better they feel about themselves and a sense of achievement that they've actually made those small changes. Because they might have a big goal, but they're not looking at the steps in between.
Mm.
I'm realising I'm doing hand signals, so that nobody can see.
You're not the only one.
so looking at the steps as to where to get to that main goal.
Yeah.
And doing it slowly and doing it properly and, you know, the sense of achievement that they feel naturally raises self-esteem and confidence.
You're quite right. And actually setting goals, I did a training course back in September And they were talking about goal setting. There's often we set goals so high that we may achieve them, but often we set them so high for ourselves because we're kind of, people tell us that we should set big, big, scary, hairy goals.
Yes, that's
that
true,
we struggle to get to them. And on this course, they said set goals so low that you can't not achieve it.
Yeah.
And I'd say this to my clients. If I said to them, I want you to go out running for 2 hours a day, they may do it, but the chances are that they will almost certainly fail to achieve that. But if I said to them, go and walk for 2 minutes a day, it's still a goal, it's still an achievement, but it's a goal that's so low that they can't not achieve it. But similar to what you've just said there, when you achieve a goal, regardless of how big or how small it is, it sets off those positive feelings in your brain that you've actually achieved something, even
yes, it
though
does,
it's something
yeah.
that potentially and, is quite small.
And they start to feel positive and confident that they can move forward a little bit more. And, you know, if you set a goal with someone that's too high and they fail, that just reinforces the fact that their own self-esteem
yeah.
and confidence, that they're no good, that
yeah.
they're a failure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's about working with people to... so that they can build resilience, so that they can build on things that they're doing and achieving and keep going and going and going. I'm not one of these coaches that says, come to me for 6 sessions and I'm going to fix you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got clients that have been coming to me for up to 2 years.
Yeah.
And have made such positive steps, but it's been over a slow process. But it's been a positive one and it's been sustainable.
And managing their expectations, I think, is important, because often when people want quick fixes, I think that's quite dangerous.
I say that to people, you
yeah.
know, I'm not here to give you a quick fix.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody comes to me for, you know, so they want to lose a lot of weight, you know, I explain to them that it's a slow process and that I would expect them to do it safely,
mm-hmm.
that it's got to work for them. You know, and they're not going to lose a couple of stone in a month because that's unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you 100%. It's probably taken them 20 years to get to where they currently are. If there's expectations, they want to lose it in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some silly plans out there that could probably achieve that, but it wouldn't be safe. It wouldn't be sustainable, in my opinion.
No, I mean, I worked in eating disorders when I first qualified as a mental health nurse
okay.
for quite a few years. And so I'm very... anti-faddy diets
mm-hmm.
because I saw how much damage issues around food could do to people. And
yeah.
I just think, you know, a healthy, balanced diet is the way forward.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I could talk for hours on that subject, but that might be a subject for another show. So tell me more about your services and the way that you're trained in things like NLP, tapping, thought field therapy. That's a bit of a tongue twister. And also CBT as well.
Well, CBT is good because it helps to change people's thought patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of these unhelpful thought patterns are what's sustaining them not being able to move forward in their lives. So I look at ways of getting them to challenge their thoughts. You know, is there any evidence in these things that are going to go wrong? What evidence have they got for that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't got any. Well, then why do you think that way? And get them to challenge their thoughts. I suppose in the same way I use NLP, very similar. But tapping is something I did my training with Marcia Tillman. And I find with the tapping, it's literally tapping the acupressure points in certain algorithms. I'm not quite sure how it works, but it's amazing how it does work, and lots of clients really find it helpful. And then they take that away as part of their toolkit. Helps
yeah.
really well with clients that suffer with anxiety.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so I've got on to your services generally speaking. In what ways can your services help people? When people work with you and they've worked with you for a while, in what ways do you actually help them? How do they feel at the end of it?
I think they feel more in control of their lives,
mm-hmm.
More resilient. They're more realistic about their goals. And they challenge themselves more. They move out their comfort zones and take risks.
Okay.
Which is another thing that I do. I do a lot of work around coming out of comfort zones.
Yeah, it's a big thing, isn't
and
it?
And how that feels, and how they can sort of keep themselves safe and keep, you know, keep their emotions under control a little bit. I use a lot of mindfulness techniques as well. I'm actually looking at starting something called armchair mindfulness, which is my next project, which is teaching people small, bite-sized mindfulness exercises they could take away with them and use in normal life.
Okay. So when do you plan to get that set up?
I'm hoping to launch it in the spring.
In 2019?
Yes.
And you've mentioned you've got a book coming out?
Yes. The Spirit of Christopher. I think most people that know me know that I lost my son, 2006, after his struggle with mental health issues. I was essentially his carer for approximately 10 years. So the Spirit of Christopher is about our journey together. I think it started off as a book about a bereaved mother, but it's evolved into a story about mental health, about giving hope to people with mental health problems, hope to carers.
Yeah.
And it's more of an all-round book. And going through the thread of it is my story and my journey with Christopher during his life and since he died.
Wow, powerful.
It is. I took a step back from it in the summer because I felt I needed to really think about how I wanted it to evolve. And it's starting to come together now. So,
and
it's going to be a legacy to him.
Brilliant. And when do you think that will be out? Sometime next year?
Sometime next year. I'm not putting an exact date on it because I want to get it right.
Get it right, absolutely. I look forward to getting one of the first editions.
I'll put you down.
A signed copy.
I certainly will, yes.
So from the services that you offer, who would be your ideal client? I'm sure you could talk to anyone, but if you're actually looking at people of a specific type and they're out there listening, who would be your ideal person to talk to?
Usually people between the ages of about 30 to 65 who've had some life experience, who want to move forward in their lives but are struggling to make that happen for various reasons. It could be emotional issues. It could be barriers that they're putting in front of them that need to be looked at and broken down. But to be honest, I don't exclude anybody if I think I'm the right coach. If I don't think I'm the right coach, then I would maybe advise them to go to a more specialist coach.
Okay. And why should people come to you particularly? Obviously, there's lots of life coaches out there, but why do you feel people should make a beeline to you and have a chat with you first?
I think with me, I've got an all-round experience of emotional and mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I've experienced it myself. I've been a carer. I've been a professional. And I just think that with my whole life experience, people often say that I have the empathy there, and dare I say it, the maturity. I did have one lady say to me, I just feel that you're the right person because I don't want to sit there talking to someone who's 20-something when I'm in my 60s because I just can't relate to them.
Yeah, and you can tell people that are genuine and people that have actually lived the experience as opposed to someone who's just studied a course but hasn't had that actual life experience.
I think so, and I do remember someone else saying that to me, you know, that the reason why I came to you is because of everything, and, you know, I looked at coaches that maybe charge quite a lot that have done a 3-month course.
Yeah.
And I don't see how that they can possibly have the knowledge to help me.
There's no substitute for experience.
No, I don't think there is. Yeah. No, I don't think there is.
So, if people want to get hold of you, what's the first step? What are your contact details? How do you operate?
Well, people can email me. A lot of people find they like to be a little bit anonymous to start with if they're making tentative inquiries and they're not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like to offer is a complimentary telephone consultation so that people can tell me a bit more about why they think coaching might help for them. so we can have a discussion around that, rather than just booking an appointment and then, you know, thinking, oh, my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
Is it the right thing for me? So when they come for the first session, they've got an understanding of what's going to happen.
Brilliant. And what are your contact details? What's your phone number or mobile or so your or email address?
My email address is rainbowcarolring@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the confusion around ring is that I got remarried and I haven't figured out how to change the email address. So, but it is definitely me.
Right, okay.
And do you know, I can't remember my mobile number, so that's...
I've got it here. 07969-998-360.
Yes.
Yep, and also your website address is www.taketherain.com.
Taketherainbow.com.
Taketherainbow.com.
Yep.
Okay, so it's rainbowcarolring@gmail.com
yep.
as the first port of call via email.
Yes, and or mobile.
Or mobile number. And I will put those contact details on the show's Facebook page a bit later on today. But thank you, Carol. It's been great to have you on the show this morning.
It's been great to be on the show. And thank you for inviting
me. It's been great to find out more about what you do. And hopefully you'll come back on the show again soon.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. So before we go on to the next part of the show, which is to talk about health in the workplace, we have another quick song. It's a classic from the 70s. It's Rod Stewart and Maggie May. was Rod Stewart and Maggie May. If you'd like to get in touch with the show's Twitter feed, the show's Twitter feed is at Health Radio Show. On Facebook, if you search the Health Matters Radio Show, you can find the show's Facebook page. You can listen again to this show and all the previous 40 shows via my show's media page on my website, which is www.i-nutrition.co.uk. And you can also find the previous shows on the show's iTunes podcast. Just search the Health Matters Radio Show. So, reasons to invest in a wellness program if you are an employer. Now, this is the thing of the moment. Okay, wellness programs are becoming more and more popular, and they are now regularly becoming part of company benefits packages. But lots of big companies do it, and lots of small companies don't, but are getting more in tune with the fact that there are benefits to investing. And I use the word investing because, yes, there is a cost, but if you do it right, an employee wellbeing program can actually give you returns that are more than what it's actually costing you. So here's six reasons why, if you are an employer, you might want to consider investing in an employee wellbeing and wellness program. So wellness programs, they improve employee health behavior. So this is the core of a good wellness program. It's behavioral change. So with the right education, the right skills, the right motivation, the right tools, and social support, people can change their behaviors. And wellness programs are good at helping people to adopt and maintain healthy behaviors. Arguably, this is one of the biggest benefits of having a wellness program, is the fact that you can help people to change their behaviors, because their behaviors have probably got them to where they are now, particularly if their health is not that good, not that good. Also, healthy behaviors can lead to lower health risks, and lower health risks can lead to less chronic disease, and less chronic disease has a less of an impact on healthcare costs. Now, obviously, we're talking about costs to the NHS. We're talking about costs to the employer, as in sickness benefit, but also costs to the employee in terms of loss of income because they are off sick long term, and or they may be paying out a lot of money for prescriptions. So the foundation of any good wellness program must be focused on helping employees to adopt these healthy behaviors. So things like elevated blood glucose, and we've covered diabetes this morning, high blood cholesterol, high blood pressure are almost certainly always caused by unhealthy diets and lack of physical exercise. And eating and exercise are behaviors. So one of the reasons you should invest in a wellbeing program is to change the behaviors of your employees. We touched on this. Wellness programs can reduce healthcare costs. Yes, there is a massive financial impact to staff that aren't well. That might just be lack of productivity, and we'll come on to that in a moment. But it could be the fact that as an employer, you're paying out sick pay for people that aren't in because they're always off sick. It could be the fact that the employee is paying money for prescriptions that if they sorted out their own health, they wouldn't necessarily need. There is the inherent cost to the system, and you know, the NHS of paying out lots of money for people who have health issues. So it can help reduce overall costs. And if you have employees that are regularly off sick with the same symptoms, we're not necessarily talking about serious chronic illnesses, but the same, you know, 2 or 3 days a month they're constantly off sick, then an employee wellbeing program can help that. Employee wellbeing programs can improve productivity. There's a condition called presenteeism. Now, presenteeism is defined as people being physically at work but not working. That doesn't necessarily mean not working, but not being as productive as they could be. So you're paying them for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, and actually they're not doing that amount of work that they're being paid for. And there's lots of reasons why they may not be productive, okay? So it might be that they don't know how to use the equipment properly, so they've not been trained. It might be that they're distracted by other employees. It might be that they don't know what they're doing. They might be tired. They might spend their time on social media. There's lots of reasons why someone can be at work but not really be at work, if you know what I mean. And one of these reasons is also poor health. So new understanding of this condition called presenteeism was revealed in a recent document published by the journal Population Health Management. And what it suggested was that smokers are more likely to have a higher presenteeism than non-smokers. Employees with an unhealthy diet were more likely to have higher presenteeism than those who had at least a basic understanding of health and nutrition and had healthy habits. And employees that didn't exercise very much were 50% more likely to have a high level of presenteeism than employees who were regular exercisers. Now, this all comes down to behaviour and changing habits. So in short, those with unhealthy lifestyle choices were regularly and substantially less productive than employees that actually had healthier habits and healthier behaviours. And obviously, if you've got these small niggling health issues, then they can lead on to other things. So other risk factors, and also, you know, long-term pain, long-term chronic disease, chronic depression. We've covered mental health this morning as well. And these are all linked to behaviours. So well-being programmes can help to combat those. They can also help to combat absenteeism. If you've got employees who are constantly off sick, and you're paying out sick pay for them, then it can help to reduce absenteeism. And workplaces with comprehensive wellness programs can experience reduced absenteeism. And it's thought that the reasons these are is because employees with good health behaviours have a lower absenteeism. Employees who can control their stress have a lower absenteeism. Employees with healthy blood pressure, cholesterol and glucose have lower absenteeism. And employees who are not overweight or obese have lower absenteeism. So if you can actually invest in an employee wellbeing program to address some or all of those issues, you can actually reduce the amount of time that your employees are off sick. And actually in America, Harvard researchers looked at the return on investment of wellness programs relating specifically to absenteeism. And they demonstrated that for every dollar spent on wellness programs, the employer saved $2.73 in reduced absenteeism. So it's quite powerful. If you invest your money in an employee wellbeing program, you can reduce not just lack of productivity, but lack of absenteeism as well. Wellness programs can help improve employee recruitment and retention because it's seen as the employer caring about their employees. Now, there's no scientific data to suggest that this is the case, but it kind of makes sense. Because what you're saying is if you invest in an employee wellbeing program, you're actually saying to your staff that they are important to you, and your staff should be the most important asset in your organization. So when an employer offers a wellness program to its employees, what the company is actually saying is, we think you are an important part of this organization and we want you to be happy and healthy and employed here for a long time. So you really do show that you care for them. You show that they are appreciated, that they're valued, that they feel welcome. And that can go a long way, not to just keeping staff, and we know how expensive recruitment costs can be, but it also can be great to attract new staff as well for less cost than perhaps, you know, putting ads in papers as it used to be. And the last one, employee wellbeing programs can help to sustain high employee morale. Now, again, it's a bit of an intangible, but you know what it's like. If you employ staff, you know when morale is good, it's a great place to be, and when morale is bad, it's not a great place to be. And this is one of the most powerful reasons to have a wellness program, in my opinion. Because do you know what? Your employees don't care about how much it's costing you. They care about their own happiness. Your employees don't share your concerns about productivity or profitability or absenteeism or presenteeism. What they care about is having a good place to work and a fulfilling and enjoyable job. And a wellness program achieves all of their needs, physical, social, and emotional. And when it's done properly, then your employees will feel appreciated and loved and valued. So what's the financial value of having employees with high morale? Well, it's quite difficult to make a calculation, but let's switch this around. What does it cost your company when your employees have poor morale? Things like complaints go up, the quality of your product or service often suffers, and problems in the workplace often multiply because poor employee morale can be contagious, and sustained poor employee morale can be a company killer. So there's a lot of research out there that said, you know, big companies are doing it, so small companies should be doing it as well. That investing into an employee wellbeing program can be one of the best investments as an employer that you can make, because it will keep your staff happy, it will keep them healthy, it will make them feel valued, and it should be seen as an investment and not a cost. And if you'd like to talk about employee wellbeing programs, then please do contact me via my website, www.i-nutrition.co.uk. It's just one of the things I do offer, and we can have a chat and we can see if I can help you. Okay, so we're going to wrap the show up now, and it's been great to have Carol on the show. So thank you again, Carol, for coming on the show this morning.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Just a quick reminder of the show's Facebook feed, the Health Matters radio show, and the iTunes podcast, and go to my media page where you can listen to this show and all previous shows at i-nutrition.co.uk. If you'd like to come on the show, as Carol has done this morning, and promote not just what you do, but who you are, and I think that's far more valuable, then please make contact with me. It'd be great to have you on the show. After the last song, we will have the Channel Radio News and Weather. And on next week's show, we're going to continue the discussion about foods that are good for women's health. But until then, I wish you a happy and healthy week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and we have a last song to play us out, Kate Bush and Wuthering Heights.
Out on the wild, windy moors, we roll and fall in green. You had a temper like my jealousy, too hard to grieve.